This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Most acutely, I think I would say in Somalia, where people, especially newborns, younger children, extremely malnourished, some of them, a good number of them, are also dying.
That's Carl Schembri with the Norwegian Refugee Council talking about the building hunger crisis in the Horn of Africa. Details coming up. Also, Sudan's latest ceasefire appears to be on shaky ground. And Mauritania's ruling party had a landslide victory in the May 13th elections. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Khartoum residents nervously held on to hopes of life returning to normal as they waited to see if Sudan's latest ceasefire would take root or fall apart like previous attempts. The 7-day truce aimed at getting aid to get to the needy and allowing besieged residents to flee the fighting was scheduled to start last night. Artillery fire and warplanes could be heard in some parts of the capital this morning, while others had an uneasy quiet. The ceasefire deal reached in U.S. and Saudi-sponsored talks in Jeddah has raised hopes of a pause in a war that has killed at least 1,000 people and driven nearly 1.1 million from their homes, including more than 250,000 who have fled to neighboring countries, threatening to destabilize a volatile region. Khartoum residents Atef Salah El-Din told Reuters News, "Our only hope is that the truce succeeds so that we can return to our normal life, feel safe, and go back to work again." The fighting has pitted the army led by Sudan's de facto leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, against the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces commander by his former deputy, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hameti. That was the first ceasefire to be formally agreed on following negotiations and includes a monitoring mechanism and a U.S. warning of repercussions for violations that would include sanctions and other tools at our disposal. Last week, the United States announced $245 million in additional support to those in Sudan and neighboring countries dealing with the ongoing humanitarian crisis. But Dagalo gave signs of the intransigence by both sides that has kept the conflict blazing since April 15th, saying, "We will not retreat until we end this coup," telling his troops it's either victory or martyrdom and victory will be ours. Both sides accused each other of an attempted power grab at the start of the conflict. Humanitarian groups say they need full funding of the United Nations $7 billion appeal for help to the Horn of Africa during this week's pledge conference, pointing to the region's growing crisis. The UN says more than 43 million people need assistance in Somalia, Ethiopia, and Kenya. Carl Schembri, East Africa Media Advisor for the Norwegian Refugee Council, says the Horn faces the worst drought in 40 years. He tells VOA's Carol Van Damme the region is tittering on the edge of famine.
This has really, first of all, displaced millions of people over the years, over the last 3 years, because they've all their crops have died, their animals, their livestock. A lot of them, particularly in Somalia, have been forced into cities where they've never lived. They've been reduced to begging. And we're seeing rising levels of critical, catastrophic hunger, what we would call normally famine. Although for technical reasons, it is not declared as such, but they are the conditions of famine. We are seeing people dying.
When you say that, okay, that's what I was just going to ask, that people are dying from hunger. They're not getting enough to eat every day.
Absolutely. We've seen with our own eyes. Our colleagues see it on the ground, particularly most acutely, I think I would say, in Somalia, where people, especially newborns, younger children, extremely malnourished. Some of them, a good number of them, are also dying. So it's as critical as death. We haven't used the famine word, the UN, and the mechanism around it for, like I said, technical reasons, but it is there and it is killing people. And it is displacing, moving people, making millions of people more and more vulnerable, having to leave everything behind. Families, separated. Sometimes the men stay back in the hope that they can still work the land, whatever that is left of it. But women and a lot of children walking kilometers on end in atrocious conditions. You are right in saying 7 billion is a lot of money, but we are also talking about a lot of people. We're talking about millions, right, of people for whom lack of action can mean death.
And it's ironic, but it's true that there are parts of the Horn where, you know, you talk about this, the worst drought in 40 years, but there's also areas where there's flooding, right?
Absolutely. So most of the drought hit areas are now getting flooded again, also in Somalia. It sounds like a contradiction or a bit of a paradox, but it is part of the whole climate disaster package, if you like. You have months on end, no water. In the meantime, all the community's resilience, all their energies, all their little resources that they have are depleted. Then heavy rains come at once, and they are not prepared to even harvest that rain because it's too much, and it just wipes away their own neighborhoods. Sounds maybe a bit strange to have these two extremes in the same places, but that's how nature works.
So under normal circumstances, if not most, many of these people are able to feed themselves, right?
Absolutely. The biggest number of displacements that we see caused by drought and flooding are mainly of people who have their own land, have their farms, or work on other people's farms, doesn't matter. But they make their living through livestock, through agriculture, and they've just now been reduced to total aid dependency because they've lost everything.
That's Carl Chembri of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Nairobi, Kenya. The delayed rape trial of Senegal opposition leader Ousmane Sonko resumed in the capital Dakar today as his party called for resistance and a national shutdown. Security forces patrolled crossroads and enforced a temporary ban on motorcycles as the city braced for another round of protests, which have flared sporadically since Sonko was first detained over the case in 2021. Sonko, 48, is accused of sexually assaulting and making death threats to a woman who worked in a massage parlor. Reporter Alpha Jallo was at the court. VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached him earlier by phone to find out about the court proceedings.
Yes, again, today the trial was adjourned the last time, and today also Mr. Sonko failed to appear in court. And his lawyer cited, you know, number of reasons, that one of the reasons they said he was not giving the summon on time. But that was dismissed by the judge and the prosecutor. They said that, I mean, Sonko receives everything, so his absence is just intentional.
And, Mr. Sonko had said he would not report in court unless his security is assured. Did that factor in his absence?
Yes, they've mentioned that his security, he mentioned about his security, but that is also, you know, the judge and the prosecutor said that these are all, Mr. Sonko is just joking with the judicial system of the country. Because if he's talking about security, according to the lawyers of the other party, they said that since he fled to Sikansor, youths are barricaded his home. They are causing a lot of problems. And because of that, he cannot side of security concerns that when he is going to the court, he is going to be manhandled or whatever. So all those things advanced by some of his lawyers are dismissed by the judge and the prosecutor.
Now, I understand his party is not happy and they are calling for resistance and what they call national shutdown. How was Dakar today after the court hearing?
Well, that's what his party is saying, that national shutdown, but that is not, you know, evident anywhere. Even in the locality where he lives in Dakar, that city Kirgori, people are moving around, you know, traffic is smooth, you know, I mean, although some school children haven't gone to school, but most of the private schools, they have gone to school, the transport, they are applying, people are going about their businesses. So there's nothing unusual in Dakar because security is seen everywhere. Security has been beefed up in all the roundabouts in the city of Dakar and also even, in the outskirts of Dakar. So his party was calling for, you know, resistance and the demonstration throughout the country. But even in Chikansor, where he's a mayor and where he's currently is, I mean, no major incident has been reported. Everything is calmed down since in the morning. Though he's still in Chikansor, he hasn't turned up for the court hearing.
Mr. Sonko has this case ongoing and he has an appeal in the Labour case. And isn't time running out for him to be able to contest for the presidency?
Yes, time is really running for him to contest the presidential election. Though in that case you've just mentioned now, the defamation case against a state minister. Now he was given 6 months suspended prison sentence and also 200 million CFA for damages. But his lawyers have already gone to the higher court, so that that decision would be, reversed. Also taking into consideration what is going to, unfold in today's hearing, so Mr. Sonko is in a very, very, very critical situation politically.
That was reporter Alpha Jallo, who he spoke with Douglas Mpuga from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. Life in an internally displaced persons camp in Goma has never been easy for the women who had to flee their homes due to conflict. In Kanya Ruchinya camp, one resident shares her ordeal as she struggles to survive. VOA's Pauline Diho has more.
In Kanya Ruchinya IDP camp, about 10 kilometers from Goma in North Kivu province, Eastern DRC, Beatrice Wagambi, mother of six, got shot while she was running away from her home in Nyasisi in May 2022, after the M23 rebels attacked her village. While hiding in the forest, she was shot by stray bullets that shattered her legs. One of her kids got shot and died on the spot. Today, she's struggling to survive.
It was during the night when the rebels arrived, and we hid in the forest. I had my baby, and I had bullets flying around. They killed my child. I was hitting my legs.
Beatrice says she's lucky to be alive, and thanks to the neighbors who came to her rescue.
I had a phone and called for help, and my neighbors came and carried me. But at that point, my baby had died, my dead baby. So they took me to a local clinic but could not operate on me. So they took me to another hospital in Bukavu.
Despite the adversity, she has found ways to survive and thrive. Today, she's expecting another baby. It's not been easy.
When I stand for a long time, I feel like my back is breaking down because I still have bullets stacked in my leg. So when I stand for a long time, I feel the shock from my legs to right above my waist, so my body is not fine.
For women like Beatrice, what keeps her going is the women in similar circumstances that have built a support system. They have found ways to make with the little they have to sustain their families. Still, they have this burning desire to return home one day. Paul Ndiho, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Reuters News reports thousands of people demonstrated today in northern Ethiopia's Tigray region to demand the return home of people displaced by a two-year war and the withdrawal of outside forces who have remained since the conflict ended. The war between government troops and their allies from neighboring Eritrea and the Amhara region on one side and Tigrayan forces on the other claimed tens of thousands of lives. It concluded with a truce in November. Reuters says millions were forced from their homes, including hundreds of thousands from land disputed by Tigrays and Amhara, whose security forces and militiamen continue to occupy the area. Humanitarian workers say Eritrean troops also remain inside Ethiopian territory in several border towns. As U.S. President Joe Biden tries to convince Republicans in Congress to agree to raise the U.S. debt ceiling, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned of an economic and financial catastrophe if Washington defaults in early June. Marcus Noland, a senior fellow at Patterson Institute for International Economics, explains to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi how that could affect African economies, which have very little they can do to contain the negative effects of such a possibility.
Well, there's two channels through which this event were to happen could affect the African economies. The first is that the impact within the United States would be to make the market for U.S. Treasury bonds disintermediate and become unstable. So interest rates in the United States would probably jump and become volatile. To the extent that African economies borrow a lot in dollars and those loans are often benchmarked to U.S. Treasuries as being the kind of risk-free asset in the world economy, when the interest rates started jumping and becoming volatile in the United States, the interest rates on those African debts would start jumping and becoming volatile as well. So the first impact would be to convey financial instability to Africa. The second effect would be through the dollar. The dollar would probably decline in value as people wanted to get out of the dollar, despite the fact that interest rates would be relatively high. That could have ambiguous effects on the African economies. To the extent they're borrowing in dollars, the domestic resource cost of that borrowing would get smaller, but it also means they may be earning less on their commodity exports that are invoiced in dollars. So basically, from the financial system, financial instability in the United States would be conveyed to Africa. That financial instability would be followed by a slowdown of the real economy in the United States. The United States banking system is quite fragile right now. Such a development would be very bad for the banking system. And then the stock market would go down, the economy would slow down more generally, and it's quite likely the United States would go into a recession. That would provoke a global slowdown in growth, and then that would be bad for Africa through what we might think of the real economy channels as different from the financial market channels. So both through financial market effects and real economy effects, Africa would be negatively impacted by a default in the United States.
What measures, if any, could African countries take to contain the negative impact of that eventuality?
Honestly, there's not a lot that African economies could do. This is really a political problem in the United States, and they don't have very much influence over the politics within the United States. In the longer run, what African economies might do, as well as other economies around the world, is move away from the United States dollar. So right now, the dollar is the predominant currency in which central banks hold their reserves. Most of the central bank reserves in the world are held in U.S. dollars. The euro is in second place, very far behind. And then the other currencies, such as the British pound and the Swiss franc and the Chinese renminbi, are only single-digit shares of central bank reserves. A default in the United States would encourage central banks and sovereign wealth funds, of which Africa has a number, to reevaluate their holdings in dollars and start moving away from the dollar, probably towards the euro, but then perhaps some of these other currencies as well. So in the long run, they could try to insulate themselves from these events by moving out of the dollar. But frankly, in the short run, there's very little they could do to protect themselves.
That was Marcus Noland, a senior fellow at Patterson Institute for International Economics, speaking with a senior analyst, Mohammed El-Shenawi. The debt ceiling limits how much the U.S. government can borrow and must be raised every few years as the federal deficit rises. Negotiators for the White House and the Republicans in the House of Representatives are expected to meet again today. Republicans want sharp cuts in U.S. government spending, particularly on programs that Democrats favor, such as aid for poor families and students. The Democrats want to raise taxes on wealthy Americans, which Republicans oppose. The Democratic Republic of Congo's Electoral Commission says it has registered around 43.9 million votes for general elections in December, up from 40.4 million in the previous poll. However, some among the opposition allege there have been irregularities. Reuters News says political tension is on the rise ahead of the December 20th polls, in which President Felix Tshisekedi is expected to seek a second term. Over the weekend, security forces fired tear gas on anti-government protests that echoed opposition candidates' complaints of delays and alleged anomalies in the run-up to the vote. According to Reuters, the demonstrators in the country of over 95 million people also are angry about rising living costs and spiraling violence in the east, where armed militia groups wrangle over land and mineral resources. Insecurity has made it impossible to register voters in several areas. A report in Uganda shows journalists there face a difficult present and uncertain future. Activists say while abuses and human rights violations against journalists decreased slightly last year, the media space remains hostile. Halima Tumani reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
The Human Rights Network for Journalists documented 94 cases of rights violations and abuses against Ugandan journalists and media practitioners in 2022. The reported cases involved assault, unlawful arrests and detention, denial of information and sexual harassment of female journalists. The 2022 Press Freedom Report, released Tuesday, misses no words in describing the environment that journalists face in Uganda. The report says the Ugandan media is dealing with an increased deterioration of democracy and the rule of law that has made it very difficult for journalists and media practitioners to thrive. Robert Sempala, the national coordinator of the Human Rights Network for Journalists in Uganda, says many journalists practice self-censorship due to the fear of being arrested or harassed.
So many have relegated themselves to self-censorship because of that fear. And that to us really speaks to the uncertainty that is looming around the media. And that is extremely dangerous because it's better to know what to expect as opposed to not knowing it. Like for instance, when one journalist says they will go for you and nobody will be able to protect you, that certainly is a looming threat around all journalists.
To demonstrate the hostility, the report's cover page has a photo of a presidential guard kicking journalist Lawrence Chitata. Speaking to VOA, Chitata recalls the day after the incident, a local newspaper, the Daily Monitor, published his photo on page one. That, he says, was when his life took a turn for the worse. Chitata, who then worked for a government newspaper, says the paper's leaders vowed to defend him until they got threats from security forces telling them to drop the matter. It was worse for Chitata, who, at the time, was assigned to cover activities of the opposition National Unity Platform Party, led by singer Bobby Wine.
The bad thing, it happened when I was covering the opposition political activities. I think they wanted to punish me for what I was doing, which was my job. There is a fear. I'm not comfortable, whether I'm safe. I don't know actually what may happen. I moved disguising myself, camouflaging, to see that I look different. I can't do my job.
Police did not respond to requests for comment on the report. The report cites the Ugandan police force for the 14th year in a row as the leading violator of press freedoms in Uganda. But Stephen Vasaliza, a member of the Uganda Human Rights Commission, says the commission recently revived quarterly meetings with heads of different security agencies to ensure no mistakes are made when the forces interact with ordinary citizens. The report calls on security agencies to discipline and hold accountable employees who are accused of violating journalist rights. rights. The report also calls on the government to lift a ban on Facebook that was imposed in 2021. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Thanks for choosing The Voice of America.